Hi there, we are James and Dan, two fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I got one here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
The following is an excerpt from the podcast Blue Poison. When the uniform comes off, Blue Poison brings you straight into the realities of frontline life. Without the sugarcoating. Hosted by Bree Allen, the show exposes what really happens when the uniform comes off. In episode 2 of Blue Poison, the subject, Ben, reflects on his years in the Victorian Police Force, the shooting in 2015 that altered the course of his life, and the long, uncertain road that followed. Before we begin the episode preview, the following newsreel provides important context for Ben's experience.
A short police chase almost cost a Victorian police officer his life this morning when he was shot in the head. The 31-year-old constable was trying to intercept a four-wheel drive at Moonee Ponds when the driver made a U-turn and shot him through the car window. Christy Cooper joins us live. Good morning, Christy. How is the police officer doing this morning?
Good morning, Anne. Well, considering he's been shot in the head, he's doing extremely well. He's currently here at the Royal Melbourne Hospital where we understand he's undergoing surgery to have a number of pellets from the shotgun removed from the back of his head. This all broke out at around 3 o'clock this morning when two junior officers in a marked car attempted to pull over the black Ford Escape. The drivers sped off but reached a blockade at the end of the street, tried to do a U-turn. That's when the officers attempted to cut the vehicle off. At that point, one of the offenders wound down a window, pulled out a shotgun and pulled the trigger.
Was that early on in your career?
Yeah, that was 2015.
Yeah, I thought it was, yeah. I was having a thought about that the other day and I'm like, I'm pretty sure I was pregnant at the time. That's why they didn't call me. But
yeah.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit just so people get context? Because I think it's pretty massive what you went through. It was hands on deck for you. We worked hours and hours and hours and just praying for your recovery.
Mm.
Yeah, because it's not every day that something like this happens.
It's yeah.
It's crazy.
I think I was on leave or come back from taking charge or something. Anyway, I think I had been on a couple of weeks off and I'd started on night shift. So this was July 2015. Anyway, while I'd been away, there'd been a whole bunch of petrol bombs thrown through Primrose and overnight. And so the previous night shift had been responding to these jobs. The families were just normal families, no connections to anything. They couldn't really figure out what it was all about, other than the assumption that who lived on that street at the time was the target. So it must have been about 3 a.m. There was a shooting at the dad place. And so the sergeant said, this might be connected. Maybe just head down the street and hang around and see what happens. And so I was a PSET. I was working with First Connie and we were just like, okay. Anyway, we drove down and another unit had met us there and it's been a fairly uneventful night. And so all the information was from the jobs was that there's a black four-wheel drive seen leaving the scene. We then, sitting waiting outside the house, had a black four-wheel drive come past us and... But nothing like really significant, nothing to say, oh yeah, this is the car. It was a black four-wheel drive. Yeah, it's about 3:30 in the morning, but it wasn't driving any different. It didn't change the way it was driving when it saw us. It just kept to the speed limit, headed down towards the road, I think. And so I just said to my officer, how long would it take from Met to here? And he said about 15 minutes. And I was like, it's been 15 minutes. And he's like, oh, we'll go see. Again, nothing to really get too excited about. So anyway, I was driven up to it. It was sitting at a red light and then it went through the red light and oh, maybe this is starting to get dodgy. But again, coming close to 4 a.m., people just do that. And so it then started driving faster and it took a left and I'd come up to it and then my offsider calls it a pursuit. And this was about, I think, a couple of weeks before they changed pursuit policy. So we could just call it whenever we felt it was necessary. So put the lights on, it started driving really fast. We'd followed it down a few turns. We'd lost it, come across it again. Anyway, it turned off and my offsider knew the area better than I did. He said, this is a one-way street. So I turned left, the lights on, driven down, and had gone into the school car park and it had turned around facing to drive back out. But then I'd driven up onto the driveway or across like the gate, but then I'd left a gap so that it could drive out, just because that's what they teach you in driver training. You can't box him in or they have to ram you. And again, I was fresh and I was, I guess, fairly naive. I wasn't thinking that this is a car that's just shot up someone's house and has come to shoot someone else. I was just, it could have been another stolen car going around. It could have been a million other things, which isn't unusual to come across other stolen cars while you're following a stolen car and to lose that one and find another stolen car and to be like, what the hell is going on? So it wasn't, again, maybe it was probably naive to looking back, but the car started to drive towards us. And what I thought had happened was it's rammed into the bonnet and I've hit my head on the side of the car, which is why I felt like this kind of massive amount of pain inside of my head. See a gun or anything. And I wasn't really assuming that it was connected anyway. And then I just remember seeing it still probably a meter away from the car, from the bonnet. And so I was like, oh, it's not. And so time slows down and it speeds up and it's all regular time. I've now then noticed that it's not at the bonnet. And then I've realized that it was a gunshot that had gone off. And then I'd pulled my head down to the center console, which obviously was a bit late, but and also did the same, but he's done the same thing at the same time. What I feel like is this kind of slow reaction. He saw the muzzle flash and then gone down to the center console. And I've got all these thoughts running through and then gone down thinking I've reacted really slow, but it's almost like at the same time as him. And he said, that was a gunshot. You okay? And I was like, no, I think it got me. And then I looked down and I was just like covered in blood and I couldn't really hear out of my right ear and I couldn't see because all my face was covered in blood. And so I was just reaching around to the back seat because I was in a sedan to find my jacket to press against it. My offsider jumped out. He's trying to get into the boot to get the first aid kit, but the car's still running, so the boot won't open. And then the radio's coming up saying, we just need to update what's happening. And so I went to grab the radio, but then I couldn't really talk properly. And then I realized that I didn't know what street we were on or that I couldn't really give a very good update. And so I yelled out, my offsider, he come around back, gave the street, gave an update saying my offsider's been shot in the head. And then, so for me, I was just pressing the jacket into the side of my head. And I guess initially my brain went crazy. Like I started picturing myself, like I'd missing half of my head and kind of my brains coming out through the side. I couldn't see it and I couldn't really gauge the amount of pain that was there, what it felt like. It felt like it was all missing. And so from that point, I just started talking to myself, like, you got to start slowing down your breathing because the slower you breathe, the slower you're going to pump your blood, the slower you're going to bleed to death. So I just sat there and while my offsider was trying to get the first aid kit, I was just focused on slowing down my breath. And then I had some fairly significant experiences, like my life flashed before my eyes, and which was really interesting. It was like insignificant moments, not insignificant, but like normal moments that kind of came to me. It wasn't the walking out of Puckapunyal from or finishing high school or finishing my sound engineering course, or it wasn't these kind of big events that came to me. it was just like sitting at home with my brothers on the couch watching TV or being at the river or things that just seemed so insignificant at the time. Not insignificant, but non-eventful. And it was just like a series of those kind of situations which kind of played out for me. And
are you just still conscious at this point in time?
Yeah. So
I'm just curious if you are having like a bit of an out of body experience or yeah.
So all of this started to happen where I'm still in my body and I'm just through like my own kind of imagination or like through my own thoughts was just seeing these series of life events. And then I had this feeling like it just came to me. It's like this was always going to happen. And that kind of calmed everything. And I was like, oh. And then it made sense. All the, in the breath work, all the meditation, all the philosophy, all of this kind of practice that I'd been using the police course to as my own kind of developmental training to test these stoic philosophies or to test my ability to keep myself in the chaos. This thought just, or this voice came to me, said this was always going to happen. And I was like, okay. And so then I'd felt everything calm down by then. And so this is all happening really fast because the sergeant got from in the station at two in about 2 minutes. I know the van got there in again about 2 minutes. And so all this is happening before anyone's there. And then I had an out of body experience where I was just looking down at myself and I just saw myself like, just because the head bleeds so badly, I was just like covered in blood. And then I came back when people started to come in and then they started to bandage my head. And I was actually, by then, felt calm about it all. It's probably just the endorphins and everything kicking in and DMT and protecting my brain from the experience. But I felt calm and I just started making jokes about it all. You know, it's like, just make sure you don't get my brains all over your hands or you're bandaging me and stuff like that. And everyone's like, man, just shut up.
Now's not the time.
Yeah. So actually, can you just grab my phone so I can send out a Snapchat? And they're like, you're an idiot. Just shut up. And yeah, I think the ambulance got there within about 5 minutes and the paramedic got there and they're like, what's your name? What's your date of birth? What day it is? And all that kind of stuff. And I was like, and we just sort all that out at the hospital because I don't want to bleed out on the street. All right, we'll just get in a stretcher. It's like, I can walk. And then I jumped up and walked to the ambulance and I stood there in the star position. They cut all my clothes off me and my vest and everything because I had to seize my vest and my gun and all that for the investigation, which is your priority. Mm-hmm. And then, I got in the ambulance, got on the stretcher. They pumped me full of fentanyl and things start to feel a bit more dreamy from there. But all my senses were just like heightened. I could almost feel like every bump of gravel on the road as the ambulance drove. Everything was upregulated, that it was super sensitized to everything. So anyway, they got to the Royal Melbourne Hospital, wheeled me in, a whole bunch of people there, detectives there to take a statement. And they got me in pretty quick for a CT scan, which showed that so it was basically a 12 gauge shotgun from under 4 meters away, the 25 entry wounds. 15 of the pellets had lodged into my skull and into my neck, and then 10 of them were like passed through. So one went under my eye, split my cheek open, some through my ear, some through the head, like through the skin. So there was 10 that they called in and out, 15 that lodged in. They did a CT scan, and which is what I was most concerned about, was that whether they'd gone into my brain and would affect me neurologically and that I wouldn't be able to keep doing the job. And so did the CT scan, doctors come down and said, good news, you've got a really thick skull, which has obviously stopped the pellets from going into your brain. They just lodged into the bone. So they just laughed about me having a small brain and being a Neanderthal.
But a beautiful head. Don't let them get you down.
That's all right. I said, that's all right. I'll take it. Whatever kind of keeps me alive. So then, what was this? This is about 4 a.m., I think. They notified my brother. He came in. He called Dad and my stepmom, who were living down there at the time as well. They were all coming in. And then my brother called Mom, who was living up in New South Wales. And there's a whole parade of brass that come through in the early morning. Then they moved me somewhere else and took me through for surgery. They cut out, I think, 3 pellets, got back to the room. And again, just lay in bed and whole kind of parade of people coming through. All like the morning shift from the station come through. All of the inspectors, supers and all that started to roll through like by mid-morning. And that was basically that. It was CERT members came, night shift came in to visit. And so the first time that I really had to myself was like 12 or maybe 1 a.m. And then because I was, again, so upregulated, I was like joking and I guess happy just to be alive and was talking to everyone and making jokes of the situation. And then like, it was dark and there was no one there and I crashed and just started crying and released a whole lot of all that fear and stuff, or not all of it, but was able to release that real acute feeling. And then I was sent home the next morning.
Yeah, right. Wow.
A friend came and took me to my place. I was living by my, at the time in an apartment, and they didn't feel that it was a good idea for me to stay there by myself. So I went and stayed with family. And so I just grabbed a bag and my friend drove me over to family. And then again, it was like friends would come visit and obviously everyone was well-meaning. And then the police association came and visited and gave me pamphlets and told me their stories, and which was, it's all great. And I was, I felt really supported. But again, I was just like bombarded with everyone else and they were obviously having a hard time dealing with it and with themselves, that I just felt like I can't be around people. I can't hold people up or talk them through it. So I said, can you just drive me home? I can't be here right now. Dad drove me home and I just went into my room for 3 days and just sat on my bed and turned my phone off and basically just meditated for 3 days straight because I wanted to just sit with it and see what came up. And then I don't know if I'd picked up an infection or something at the hospital because I got really sick and I was hallucinating and my pillows turned into a giant worm and I was really annoyed at it because I was trying to sleep and it kept moving. So I was punching this worm to stop wiggling around so I could sleep better, and bed turned to a pit of worms and it was like that for a while and then came out the other side. And yeah, within 2 weeks I was back at the gym, and then another 2 weeks I had another round of surgery where they tried to cut some out and they couldn't get any of them. And so now I just gave up, like just from going through general anesthetic, and they hacked up the side of my head and the scars were worse from the surgery than from the shooting. And then another 2 weeks after that, from when this surgery healed, I was back at work on light duties. It was about 6 weeks. And then I stayed on light duties for, I can't remember, maybe this would be like maybe September or so.
Were you seeing a psychologist or a counselor or anything during this phase?
So I had a psychologist, but WorkCover had me see their GP, who had me touch my toes and tap my knee and all that kind of stuff, and said, "Oh, no, you're fit to be back at work." And they sent the report that I should be back at work. And the GP that was looking after me was an ex-police surgeon. And he said, "No, there's no way you'll ever go back to work. It's not possible. So I won't sign off on you going back to work." And the psych, he was leaving it up to me to see how I felt. And he was happy for me to try and get back to work. And then eventually WorkCover said, "You don't need a psych," and they stopped paying for it. And then the doctor had something wrong with his kidney and had to retire. And then I saw some other doctor, and he just said, how do you feel? I was like, I did pretty good. He signed my form to go back to work. So it all happened fairly quick. And
do you feel you were ready or do you feel you're more pushed?
I didn't feel I was pushed. I feel that at that time, I felt I was invincible. And so I was like, I got shot in the head and I'm fine. I can go back to work. I think there was obviously a lot of pressure from work colour to get back to work straight away. But I feel there was enough protections with the GP, with the psych, with the bosses and stuff at the station. But everyone was felt like they were being guided by me. They were like, well, what do you need? And I guess it was, it's not a routine thing. It was not something that anyone was, I guess they didn't want to have an opinion on or didn't want to make that decision for me. But I also think that it was probably a time where I needed some guidance, like external guidance to say, no, look, just, and looking back, I should have spent more time away and the whole healing process would have been much less like a roller coaster, I assume. Maybe it was the best possible scenario, and going back that quick, while I was able to resolve a bunch of things, I don't know. So I went back on light duties and went to collect some CCTV footage for someone, and then stumbled across a knife fight because they and then went out another day for coffee run and come across someone trying to break into a car. So everyone just determined that I should just kit up and be back on the road. And then my first shift on the road ended up hands-on with a mental health patient. We end up destroying this whole living room trying to get this dude in handcuffs. And yeah, so it was a wild ride for a long while. But yeah, obviously to answer your question ages ago, I had a whole lot of practices in place to, I guess, support myself as far as like the training. I was back at the gym within 2 weeks and I was able to feel that strength back up and feel confident in my body again and support myself through like nutrition and a whole lot of things to, you know, to speed up or improve the healing of the scars or like the, all the physical aspect of things. But then also understanding some like biochemical responses and how certain nutrients can support that.
Each episode tells a different story. To hear the rest of this one and stories like it, find the full episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.